And your work led you across this story of Harry Bridges. And tell us a bit about, if you can capsulize the story of Harry Bridges and how it's so unique.
You bet. So Harry Bridges' story is one of the ideological deportation trials coming out of the Cold War when the executive branch of the government, in a time of great fear, exerted massive control and dominion over the immigration system in order to achieve political ends. And one of the, and those constellations of cases that came out of that, and if you zoom in on one of them, of Harry Bridges, it's sort of a fantastic petri dish for that time's fears and then the governmental response to those fears. And so Harry Bridges was a longshoreman working on the Embarcadero in terrible working conditions and had come from Australia with sort of these progressive Australian labor beliefs when at the time Australia was far ahead of America in terms of labor policies and practices. And in those tough times of the Great Depression, he started speaking loudly about the need for a real union and worker rights, fair wages, safe working conditions, social security, that type of stuff. He was just a worker, but his voice was pretty powerful on the waterfront as he spoke, and men started listening to him. And he formed a sort of faction and coalition within sort of a sham union that existed, demanding real change. And eventually, as things came to a head, he was able to provoke the largest strike in West Coast history at the time and shut down West Coast shipping for several months. For a few days, it was a general strike. In the middle of all this, several longshoremen protesters were killed when the police opened fire on them. Hundreds were injured. And eventually, the federal government forced a resolution to this, but the resolution created a real union. And in turn, Harry Bridges became president of that union. So in a couple of years, he went from, loud dissenting voice to now running a union, institutionalizing those, political and economic beliefs. And the moment he did that, cries went up from the private sector and from governmental sectors, including some at the INS and some state officials in Oregon, all decried him as a communist, because at the time, if a non-citizen was a member of the Communist Party, they could be deported. And so his economic power to change the status quo provoked this backlash against him as they raced to find ties between him and the Communist Party. And when they couldn't prove that he was actually a member of the Communist Party, they actually manufactured evidence. And that then began a 20-year odyssey as he was put through serial deportation trials using trumped-up evidence and perjuring witnesses in this literally two-decade campaign to deport him.
And it made it all the way to the Supreme Court, correct?
It did. I mean, one of the remarkable parts to his story is his case went to the Supreme Court twice. And on two separate occasions, the Supreme Court condemned the executive's behavior in terms of how it was managing the immigration system and what it was doing to this one man, Harry Bridges. And he prevailed by one vote. But even after the Supreme Court issued what is quite literally a wrath of constitutional condemnation against executive zeal, the government still spent 10 years going after Harry Bridges. They just, the FBI, the executive policymakers in the INS and the Department of Justice refused to listen to the Supreme Court, and they, came up with new legal tricks to put him through another 10 years of deportation proceedings. And sort of that's one of the remarkable twists to the tale, because it was a time when the Supreme Court was willing to stand up, notwithstanding the frenzied, fear-laden era that we lived in at the time. But the Supreme Court stood up for due process and demanded the executive follow, but it still wouldn't follow for several years until more federal judges, forced compliance by demanding the Constitution be respected.
Bridges eventually was granted citizenship. Is that true?
That is true. He swore in as a citizen and eventually, was able to become a citizen and not be subjected to deportation proceedings. So when the 20-year saga ended, he finally was sort of free in the sense that he was now able to be an American citizen and not be subjected to this ongoing onslaught of, trying to put him in prison or his friends in prison or try to strip him of his citizenship. And led the union and continued to live out his life in the United States, and fighting for his union and for change. And if, when in his later years, he was a heavy advocate for world peace during the Cold War and the fear of, the nuclear war issue in the 1980s in particular, and elderly rights he lobbied for heavily in his later years. He sort of, in that sense, became this kind of quintessential American success story of up by your bootstraps, hard work, success, you know, fighting for the common man, you know, and living a life of dignity without feasting on all the wealth and the intrigue that he could have feasted on. He never amassed wealth, even though he ran this powerful union. And so he was sort of, compared to all the other major national labor union leaders, he was in effect the poorest because he demanded that he never be paid more than the highest paid longshoreman. And it was that sort of hero's tale that carried him through his journey as he defied the U.S. government.
And many of the parts of his tale are being sort of revisited again today in the headlines. Is that true?
It is true. I mean, it's one of the remarkable, you know, factors that we see going on in society today, that we have this battle again that's brewing both politically over immigration and the anxiety today about foreigners, terrorism, Islamism, Muslims, right? And, you know, it's not communism today, but we have a whole set of new isms today and that are being used politically the same way they were during the Cold War, but they're being used politically to divide and accomplish political ends. And that has pitted the executive branch of the government today against the judicial branch. And there's this massive reinvigoration of the same battle that occurred during Harry Bridges' time between the executive branch that wants to exert total dominion and control over the immigration system to the exclusion of the federal courts, to the exclusion of the Constitution and precepts and dictates of due process. And just as in Harry Bridges' time, today again, the federal courts and just in 2017 have been called upon repeatedly to have to assess and decide whether President Trump's and the executive's immigration policies are legitimate and lawful or whether they're excessive and in violation of the Constitution. And literally, just as Harry Bridges went to the Supreme Court has some of President Trump's executive orders pending before it now. So it is a case of history repeating itself in these fascinating battles between the executive and the judicial branch over separation of powers and the Constitution, all over the immigration system and what kind of an immigration landscape we're going to have.
When did you discover Harry Bridges' story?
Well, I knew about the case because I've done pro bono political asylum litigation for almost 20 years, and I've taught a clinic for 17 years with my students. And so in that clinic, I've regularly cited in my briefs the case Bridges versus Wixon. And it's a known case for some high-level propositions, such as, you know, when you're deporting someone, you have to use meticulous care because they have an established life here, and so you can't just willy-nilly deport someone. And so I've always known of the case, and I had read the opinion and the beautiful moving language as the court condemned the government action, but I didn't really know the full backstory. And I honestly, after I wrote my first book about the contemporary immigration system, wanted to go back and have a better understanding of why it was the U.S. government so zealously wanted to deport an Australian, because he was an Anglo-Saxon from Australia, and that's not the prototypical person who finds themselves in vicious deportation proceedings. And so in digging into the backstory and looking in the National Archives at the trial transcripts, and I did some FBI FOIA requests and got really some remarkable documents, I realized there was this deep, deep story of the executive against the immigration, of the really critical role of pro bono lawyers who fought and suffered massive public scorn themselves to defend the Constitution for their client. And those stories, as they played out, were just so compelling to me as a practicing lawyer today that, and no one had written about it, I realized, wow, I have to sort of detail this into a book.